with vaccinating their animals. The nomads' cattle would be immunized against brucellosis and anthrax bacterial infections. Protecting the animals also protected the nomads from these infections, he says, and motivated their cooperation towards having their children receive polio vaccine. A win-win situation. Polio eradication has been a long journey, but we're getting close, Ohuabunwo says. The new oral polio vaccine is another light in the tunnel.
Africa Today.
Industrial development is of critical importance for sustained and inclusive economic growth in African countries. South African President and African Union Chairperson Cyril Ramaphosa addressed a recent session of the African Union Summit on the African Continental Free Trade Area. He noted that the commencement of trading under this Free Trade Area Treaty on the 1st of January 2021 will boost industrialization.
Our treaty will boost intra-African trade. It will promote industrialization and competitiveness and contribute to job creation.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today, which is focusing on the challenges of industrialization in Africa. In the second part of our show, we are asking and we are analyzing the failure by West African countries to launch their eco-common currency as planned in 2020. We are asking, is France sabotaging efforts to dump the CFA franc in West Africa?
Africa's industrialization challenges. Despite being the second most populated continent in the world, with a population of 1.2 billion people, Africa represented only 1.4% of the world manufacturing value added in the first quarter of 2020. The COVID-19 pandemic has worsened the situation, and this has impacted negatively on the industrial sector. Economic growth expected to fall to -3.3% in 2020 in sub-Saharan Africa, pushing the region into its first recession in 25 years.
The COVID-19 pandemic brought about disruption to global supply chains and forced a rethink of local manufacturing capability. This has created an opportunity for the African continent, particularly now that the African Continental Free Trade Agreement will be coming into effect from January. Speaking at an African Free Trade Agreement business forum in Kigali, Rwandan president said the agreement is expected to spur manufacturing in the continent.
This agreement is about trade in goods and services. These are the kinds of complex products that drive high income economies. African workers adding value in Africa, services offered by African professionals using the latest technologies, manufactured goods that are made in Africa.
Now, the path towards industrialization in Africa, however, faces a myriad of challenges. To discuss this, we are joined by Joseph Ochieno, a writer and an African affairs analyst. Thanks a lot for your time, Mr. Ochieno. Now, why has Africa failed to industrialize despite being the source of a huge chunk of raw materials used in industrialized countries?
I think there are very many reasons, but mostly historical. I, I, think Africa's challenge goes back to half centuries, considering that with the huge amount of resources that we do have, and we have always had over centuries, we're literally enslaved, and so therefore controlled over centuries. So we became the source for raw materials, and our people were never ever allowed to participate in the day-to-day management of their own affairs. In fact, until not so long ago, you know, we could not even become independent nation states. In a way, that's one. But number two, I think much more recently, no huge excuse, the challenge has been leadership in Africa.
Mr. Ochino there says that leadership is crucial if Africa is to industrialize. Well, Rwanda seems to be providing some leadership. This East African country banned second-hand clothes imports, mainly from the United States, in 2018. The ban was aimed at boosting its textile industry. Now, as a result, the U.S. ended Rwanda duty-free export privileges. Rwanda has insisted that the move to ban imports of second-hand clothes from the United States is meant to boost local industries.
We want to achieve two goals in the country. One of them is to really support the local producers, because they're there. We're not just opening up the market for them to do business. We also want to understand how we can make them competitive.
Mr. Ochieno, how have imports from Western countries been a major impediment to the development of African industries?
In the presence of decent and responsible governments, that should be regulated, and most regulations normally would be either through taxation or, if you like, conditional development.
Mr. Ochieno, you have spoken there about the need for proper government policies to stop unregulated imports from industrialized nations. Now, do you think lack of political commitment and the audacity to implement the right policies is an impediment to Africa's quest for industrialization?
Politics determines, you know, the trends around the world, whether it's in industry, in service, in security, and in everything else. I think, as far as Africa is concerned, there will have to be a enormous and substantial change in terms of the political values on the continent. And unless and until we have and begin to have leaders who are not only democratically elected, but those that are accountable to the people, and those who know that after 4 or indeed 5 years of their term, whichever that is, first or second terms, they will be subject to a critical rigor of their programs over that period of time, and so therefore they will have to present what my late president used to call the balance sheet to the citizenry. We will continue this way. So political will is lacking in many cases.
Well, Mr. Ochieno there believes that the lack of political will is a barrier in Africa's quest for industrialization. However, some countries have shown political will.
Ghana's president, Nana Akufo-Addo, is successfully implementing the One District, One Factory program. The aim is to change the nature of Ghana's economy from one which is dependent on import and export of raw material to one which is focused on manufacturing, value addition, and export of processed goods.
In partnership with the private sector, we'll establish one factory in each of the 216 districts across the country. One district, one factory.
A technology-savvy educated workforce is more important than ever in today's fourth industrial revolution. Rwanda's President Paul Kagame believes that quality education systems in Africa, especially in secondary schools, are critical for the continent's long-term development goals.
Africa's path to prosperity will be defined by the quality of our schools. And secondary school is the critical link that prepares young people to succeed in the workplace. This report sets out some key principles we need to take on board to adapt our secondary education systems for the future. Digital literacy, science, and technology have to be absolutely central because the world of work is going to continue to change in unpredictable ways.
Do African countries have enough technical know-how to effectively enter the fourth industrial revolution?
think that's a very interesting question. As an African, as an African who believes that I have got sufficient capacity to think, and who's generally surrounded by not so uneducated Africans, I actually think, by and large, we've got the capacity to be able to do so. And again, as an African who travels across the continent, and indeed the rest of the world, particularly in Western Europe and North America, I know Africans with huge capacity to compete at the highest levels. I think that is possibly not the issue. The issue is whether or not today our educational systems on the continent are geared sufficiently enough to train and to capacitate and to equip the young Africans, particularly the young graduates of the African continent, on the next set of skills in terms of equipping post, educational post, if you like, training with sufficient skills to compete in the global market. I think that part of it is a problem. The other thing, though, is that if we're talking, as we're saying, mashallah, Chinese investments and many others in terms of Western investments, you realize that many of these guys come with some of their own already substantially skilled at the top end of skills management. And in this case, therefore, you find that the African is generally very much confined.
Very well put there. Africans have the capacity to compete at the highest technical levels. Mr. Ocheno, at the start of our show, we heard about the African Continental Free Trade Area. How will this trade bloc boost industrial development in Africa?
Already, cross-border trade, in a very simplistic way, tends to be quite huge, because many of these cases about communities. Even today, in my previous assignment and conversations and commitments, I was having conversations with people some of whom were having engagements from across the borders, more than a single border, in fact. So that is possible. The problem, though, is the volume of that trade. Other than the informal element of the trade, the volume of the formal trade, where you still find African countries subjecting their neighbors, in fact, in many cases, sister nations, to huge level of taxations, and there is still a huge amount of living in impediments that, you go to a neighboring country and forget about trade. You simply find that crossing the border to a neighboring country, you know, people queue for far longer than they would possibly try to seek for visas going to some of the established nations. I think there's still a huge problem.
Well, a lot more needs to be done in terms of putting the right policies in place for African countries to effectively compete globally.
Where is West Africa's echo currency?
The decision by 8 mainly Francophone West African countries to abandon the CFA currency that they have been using since before their independence from France was touted as the end of French stranglehold on the region.
At the end of 2019, Emmanuel Macron announced that France wanted a reform of the CFA franc. Two currencies, the West African CFA franc used in 8 West African countries and the Central African CFA franc used in 6 Central African countries. According to the current arrangement, these countries must deposit 50% of their respective foreign exchange reserves to the French Finance Ministry. Chiefs of the 15-nation economic community of West African states, ECOWAS regional bloc, said in 2019 the CFA franc will be replaced with the ECO in 2020. However, hopes to launch ECO currency have faded amid the coronavirus crisis and squabbling over severing the remaining monetary ties with the former colonial ruler, France. Speaking in June, Nigerian president cautioned his counterparts in ECOWAS bloc of possible dangers brought by ECO if not well thought out.
We cannot ridicule ourselves by entering a union to disintegrate potentially no sooner than we enter into it. We need to be clear and unequivocal about our position regarding this process. We must also communicate same to the outside world effectively. We have all staked so much in this project to leave things to mere expediencies and convenience.
Now, to get some insight on why the eco-currency failed to take off as expected, we have contacted Daniel Lazar, journalist and political analyst. It's good to have you with us, Mr. Lazar. Now, can you tell us, what's your take on the failure by West African countries to establish the eco-currency in 2020 as previously agreed?
There are a lot of reasons. I mean, first of all, these economies are very weak, and they're getting weaker due to the global recession since the pandemic hit. And so in the European common market, those countries grew together during a time of unprecedented economic boom. But what we see in Africa, in Central and West Africa, is the exact opposite. I mean, a deepening recession, and as the recession strikes, forces of disunity grow stronger. So therefore, the likelihood of them coming together behind some kind of common market and a common currency seem to be diminishing. So there's still a lot of talk, but the talk seems to be going nowhere.
Thanks a lot, Mr. Lazar, for that.
Despite statements, French President Emmanuel Macron appears not interested in ending the unequal and unfair relationship with countries that were colonized by his country in Africa. France continues to control the trade and currency of these former colonies. The maintenance of economic domination allows the prolongation of political domination. Is France involved in behind-the-scenes moves to prevent West African countries from having a new currency not tied to Paris?
I think France probably wants to maintain the CYA franc because, in general, it wants to keep a hand in those countries' internal affairs. But the war on terror, the international intervention in Libya has harmed those which France supported, of course, has harmed those countries immensely. I mean, the overthrow of Gaddafi in 2011 led to a huge spread of Libyan arms throughout the region and helped create chaos and subvert governments, you know, in across the French-speaking area. So France's policies, not only its currency policies, but its broader policies in support of the global war on terror, have just wreaked enormous damage, have imposed enormous damage on those countries.
Mr. Lazar there has pointed out that French policies have imposed damage on CFA franc zone countries. By the way, the lowest ranking countries in the 2019 UNDP Human Development Index, namely Chad, the Central African Republic, and Niger, are in the CFA franc zone. Clearly, reliance on France comes with a heavy price for these resource-rich countries. Mr. Lazar, why do governments in this region lack political resolve to disentangle their nations from French monetary imperialism?
Well, I'm just skeptical of any attempt to put all the blame on the currency question. I mean, I think that the currency issue is part of the problem, but the bigger problem is French foreign policy in general, the war on terror, which has actually led to more terror, more weapons, and more terror throughout the region, and the weak economies in Central and West Africa, and therefore the growing forces of disunion.
Thanks a lot for that, Mr. Lazar.
Money is an instrument of sovereignty for a state. But even 60 years after independence, the former colonies of France and Central and West Africa did not have it. Will a delay in rolling out the eco currency negatively impact on the economies of these African countries?
They've been talking about an eco for years. The African equivalent of the euro, but the preconditions don't exist, and those preconditions involve strong local economies and some kind of tendency to greater political union, and we just haven't seen that. I mean, first of all, the eco region is divided by language between French and English, and that creates growing problems. And secondly, the countries, while they talk about unity, all their actions are in the opposite direction. So the basis for a common ecozone that would be analogous to the eurozone in the EU, I mean, just don't exist. And you can't regard currency as a kind of a, you know, a magic wand or an electric switch that you can flick on and off. You have to have, you know, years of political foundation laying before that is even possible.
While some countries in West Africa have expressed reservations on the single currency in the region, in June, Gambia President Adama Barrow addressed his colleagues in a virtual meeting. He said his country remains committed to the revised roadmap of the ECOWAS Monetary Cooperation Program.
I will emphasize here that the Gambia remains committed to the revised roadmap of the ECOWAS Monetary Cooperation Program. This commitment has been translated into sustained improvements on achieving the set of macroeconomic convergence criteria. Since 2017, the Gambia has constantly achieved three of the four primary convergent criteria, missing only the budget deficit criteria.
What needs to be done to speed up the establishment of the eco currency?
I mean, when you saw the establishment of a common market in Europe in 1948, I believe it was. The economies were growing, the countries were coming together in a new burst of democracy in the wake of the defeat of Nazi Germany. Strong democratic institutions were being developed, and those all came together to form a European common market, which eventually grew into the EU and the Eurozone. So you just can't turn these processes on and off like with a flick of a switch. You've got to lay a strong political foundation, and that's not happening. That would require a huge change in political circumstances in Central and West Africa. It would require basically a democratic revolution, and that simply is not taking place.
A strong political foundation is a prerequisite for a powerful monetary union in West Africa. That's Mr. Lazar's take on the path West African nations need to take if they are to achieve dreams of a common currency. Now that wraps it up for this edition of Africa Today. Thanks a lot. On behalf of the entire Africa Today team, I would like to thank you all. And until next time, it's goodbye from me and God bless you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The West is obliged to lift the sanctions against Iran immediately. Imam Khamenei used to address the whole nation on the anniversary of the January 8, 1978, which is 19th of Day Uprising, in the presence of thousands of people from Qom in the Husseiniyah of Imam Khomeini. The Islamic Republic does not have the right to develop the country's defensive capability so that incompetent individuals such as Saddam Hussein will be able to bombard and drop their missiles on Tehran, and their MiG-25 fighter planes can fly over Tehran while we are not able to do anything. This happened during the imposed war, and we did not have sufficient facilities. Today, our defensive power is such that our enemies have no choice but to consider Iran's capabilities in their calculations. When the Islamic Republic's missiles are capable of striking a U.S. drone flying in Iranian airspace, and when Iranian missiles are able to shatter the Ain al-Assad base, then the enemy has no choice but to take into account our country's power when making military decisions.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, my Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
Nowadays, they talk about the U.S. returning to the JCPOA. However, we do not insist on this at all, and we are in no rush for the U.S. to return to the JCPOA. This is not the issue for us whether the U.S. returns to the JCPOA or not. If the sanctions are not lifted, then the U.S. return to the JCPOA might even be to our disadvantage. Not only will it not be to our advantage, it will also be to our disadvantage.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
The Debate.
The U.S. has rejected a plea by the U.N. to reverse a decision declaring Yemen's Ansarullah movement a terrorist group. U.N. officials have opposed the designation, citing its humanitarian impact and the dire consequences for the peace process in Yemen. U.N. Humanitarian Chief Mark Lowcock has said the designation could cause a famine not seen in the past four decades. Yemen has been devastated by the Saudi-led war that started back in 2015, the UN has described Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Ansarullah and its allied army units are fighting Riyadh and its regional allies, which are backed by Washington. The designation will come into effect on January the 19th, the last full day in office of President Donald Trump's administration.
In March 2015, Saudi Arabia and some of its allies launched a war on Yemen. Their main aim was to throw out the Ansarullah movement and reinstate former President Abd Rabu Mansour Hadi, who had fled to Saudi Arabia after resigning. The war that so far had killed tens of thousands of Yemeni civilians has been described by the UN as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. But right from the beginning, it was the United States and its Western allies that supported the war in different forms, either by supplying weapons to Riyadh or undermining the situation in Yemen. With only a few days left for U.S. President Donald Trump in office, he is still trying to do the most harm to the Yemeni people and offer political assistance to his Arab ally, Saudi Arabia. On Monday, the U.S. designated Yemen's Ansarullah as a terrorist group. Washington said the decision will take effect on January 19th, a day before Trump hands over power to his successor, Joe Biden. The move has drawn criticism from the international community and rights groups. UN officials have also opposed the designation, citing humanitarian impact and dire consequences for the peace process in Yemen.
I am extremely concerned about the impact of the decision from the United States to designate Ansarullah as a foreign terrorist organization. We fear, in my mission, that there will be inevitably a chilling effect on my efforts to bring the parties together.
During a UN Security Council briefing, World Food Programme Chief David Beasley also slammed the decision and called on the US to reverse it.
We are struggling now without the designation. With the designation, it's going to be catastrophic. It literally is going to be a death sentence to hundreds of thousands, if not millions.
The US and some other Western countries are major suppliers of weapons to Saudi Arabia and have been supporting the war on Yemen since day one. Saudi bombardments have already devastated Yemen's infrastructure, turning many schools, hospitals, religious sites into rubble. But the Trump administration never heeded calls by rights groups and politicians inside the US to stop supplying arms to the kingdom. The United States has a history of military adventurism in West Asia. The Saudi-led war is part of a wider American plot to destabilize the region. Will Biden do something to stop the Saudi mayhem or follow the footsteps of his predecessor? That's what the world will be watching in the coming weeks.
Well, joining us on this debate, we have Mr. Mike Wallace, who is a member of European Parliament from Ireland South, joining us from Brussels. Also, we have Director of Human Rights for Yemen, Kim Sharif, joining us from London. Ms. Sharif, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mike Wallace in Brussels. Mr. Wallace, the U.S. has rejected pleas by numerous U.N. officials to reverse its decision declaring the Ansarullah movement a terrorist group. The U.N. Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, Mark Lowcock, has insisted that the U.S. must reverse its decision to avoid the risk of a famine not seen for decades. Why is the U.S. not considering these calls when the scope of death and devastation is clearly being pointed out?
Well, I don't understand why you'd be surprised at that. There's been a famine, and there's been huge problems in Yemen for a long time now, caused by the Saudi-UAE bombing campaign, supported by the U.S. and, sadly, some of the European countries. And they haven't cared about the lives of the people of Yemen up to now. I don't know why you start thinking that they start caring about them in the last week of the presidency. And listen, don't forget as well, this started in 2015. And in March 2015, Obama was involved, and sadly the UN were involved, in allowing the Saudis and the UAE to start their bombing campaign. So the attitude of the US, whether they're Republican or Democrat, it hasn't been good in this situation. There is no rationale to the support to what the Saudis are doing. The truth be told, without mincing the words, what the Saudis in the UAE have engaged in Yemen is a form of genocide. They have literally been looking to starve the people into submission. They have targeted food production, they have targeted food warehouses, they have targeted water supply, they have targeted sanitary facilities, they have targeted medical facilities. This has been an attempt to beat the people of Yemen into submission. And it is very striking that there's so little coverage of the war in world media. There's been so little coverage at European Union level. I can tell you, I became a member of the European Parliament in July 2019. Now, there's hardly been a month since where I haven't tried to get Yemen raised as a topic of debate at the plenary, and I still haven't managed to do so. Next week, we will discuss Hong Kong for the fifth time. There's not one protester has been killed by Chinese police authorities in Hong Kong yet. And yet, we're talking for the fifth time in the European Parliament about the suppression of democracy in Hong Kong. And listen, I'm not saying there isn't problems there. There's problems everywhere. But yet, we cannot talk about Yemen in the European Parliament, despite the fact that it does represent probably the worst humanitarian crisis on the planet at the moment.
All right, let's turn over to Ms. Shetty in London. The executive director of the UN World Food Program, David Beasley, has called on the U.S. to reverse its controversial decision. He warned quote, we are struggling now without the designation. With the designation, it's going to be catastrophic. It literally is going to be a death sentence to hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of innocent people in Yemen. Why is the U.S. ignoring these warnings?
That's because U.S. Itself has a history of committing genocide on the natives of America. That's how the U.S. came into existence. U.S. history is thoroughly tainted with bloodshed and extermination of people systematically. And U.S. cannot handle the fact that Yemen is another country that has come out of U.S. hegemony. And that's what is worrying the U.S., and it doesn't care how many millions of people die. Because if you think of the figures that of children, for example, there are 50,000 children under the age of 50 dying per annum due entirely to an illegal blockade, arbitrarily enforced, strictly enforced, complete disregard to U.N. Search mechanisms, etc. So 50,000 children under the age of 5 alone per annum, that is horrifying. That's clearly genocide. That is terrorism, my friend. That is exactly what terrorism is about, is terrorizing the people of Yemen into submission. And that's what this decision, which is irrational and illegal, is about. If we want to go and talk about who are the terrorists, real terrorists are really basically Saudi coalition, who are friends of the U.S. Let's go back and look at the time, how this business of terrorism started. In the 80s, the U.S. regime itself used the Saudi regime to recruit terrorists for the Afghan Mujahideen war to face the Soviets. Hillary Clinton admitted on TV that they created these terrorist outfits in order to confront the Soviets. Mohammed bin Salman also admitted that he created these Takfiri Wahhabi extremist terrorists in order to assist their friends, U.S., etc. So for them now to turn around and call Ansarullah, who are the only party in Yemen who have been very successful at fighting terrorism to the extent that they have eliminated all forms of terrorism from the areas under their control, to call these people terrorism is itself terrorism, in my view, because it seems to me that U.S. regime is using political terrorism now as a last resort to try and force the Yemeni people to submit to its will. And that's just not going to happen. The difficulty with the U.S. is that it cannot face losing another war to another small country, defenseless, weak, small country like it happened in Vietnam. And on this occasion, in relation to Yemen, it had used its puppet regimes, its proxies, Saudi coalition, to do its dirty work in return for selling them unlimited amounts of weapons of mass destruction and making them believe that they're going to be dominant empires in the region, which is a false promise that is never going to happen. And in addition, they are using terrorist proxies as ground forces. This has been reported widely by many, many highly respected outlets like CNN. Al-Qaeda and Daesh are receiving weapons from Saudi coalition. Safar Ahmed of the BBC reports that ground forces working alongside the Emiratis are Al-Qaeda and Daesh. The southern parts that are occupied by Saudi coalition are facing daily attacks of terrorism, assassinations, and you know the recent attack of Aden Airport and so on. All of these activities of terrorism actually belong to the U.S. regime and its proxies, Saudi coalition. And the terrorist outfits such as Al-Qaeda and Daesh are nothing more than third grade, if you like, third grade proxies to carry out their dirty work for them. We've seen evidence of that in Syria, we've seen evidence of that in Iraq, and we see it in Yemen almost every day happening. You know, when we have regained control of Al-Baydar province, there were so many nationalities from Chechnya, from Pakistan, from Bangladesh, from everywhere, Senegalese. These are terrorist mercenaries purchased by Saudi coalition on behalf of their U.S. masters to come and kill Yemenis in their own country. And so to designate Ansarullah terrorists, okay, terrorists is actually itself is terrorist. And in any event, we don't believe the U.S. regime anymore about this business because,
indeed,
having passed the JASTA law, to date, we haven't seen them indict or try any member of the Saudi royal family who are implicated in the 9/11 worst terrorist attack in recent history.
Okay,
so why haven't they tried any one of them?
I'll get
but
back
we don't
to
believe
in a minute,
their
Ms.
intelligence
Shadi,
at all.
I'm sorry,
Iraqi
I'm going to interrupt you there. We're going to go back to our guest in Brussels, Mick Wallace. Mike Pompeo insisted that the State Department was aware of the concerns and would work with non-governmental groups and the United Nations to ensure that aid goes through. In that regard, Mark Locock has stated the following, that would licenses and exemptions for aid agencies prevent a catastrophe? The answer is no. What would prevent it? A reversal of the decision. Well, aid agencies cannot, they simply cannot replace the commercial import system. So here we have the same song and dance again. It's U.S. sanctions targeting innocent civilians.
Yeah, look, I don't think anyone really cares about what Mike Pompeo thinks or says anymore. He's on the way out, and he's been a loose cannon for a long time and never made an awful lot of sense when he spoke anyway. And it was a poor reflection on America that they had allowed someone like Pompeo to behave in that position in such a reckless fashion for a long period. So, I mean, I don't think anyone should be surprised with anything that what Pompeo would say or do. Whether the people replacing him would be much different remains to be seen. But the truth is that what the Saudis have been doing since 2015 and the UAE would not have been possible without Western support. The Saudis, they don't have their own soldiers in there. They can't train their own soldiers. They can't repair their own vehicles and aircrafts. They can't fuel their own aircrafts in the air without US or French or UK support. This war could not take place without Western support. And yet, the Western countries themselves have so little to say about it, but they have been happy to make money from it. They have been happy to sell arms to the Saudis and to the UAE, irrespective of what they do with them. It just goes to show, I mean, we hear the likes of the French and the British and the Americans pontificating about human rights, and yet they would sell arms to anybody to do anything, because it's just about the money. And they make money from arms. I mean, Trump, in his honesty, once said, when it was put to him by a journalist in Washington, and the journalist said to him, "Do you not think, Mr. President, that maybe it's time that we stop selling arms to the Saudis because they're doing terrible things in Yemen with the arms that we're selling them?" And Trump says, "Ooh, I'm not so sure about that. I'm not so sure that'd be a good idea. Supposing we didn't sell arms to them. Supposing it meant that we lost 20,000 jobs because the Saudis and the UAE didn't buy any arms from us. First of all, we'd lose money, we'd lose jobs, American jobs, and where would the Saudis buy the stuff then? The Russians? The Chinese? Don't think this is a good idea," he says. I mean, look at it. There's no morals involved. There's no principles involved.
Right.
The large powers of the world, like the US, sadly, no longer have any respect for international law. And that's a big problem.
Kim Sharif in London, a spokesman for Yemen's Houthi Ansar movement, said the regime's waging war under the protection of U.S. President Donald Trump, who's leaving office in just a matter of days, must now stop their bloody aggression. Do you think a Biden administration's policy will be any different from the Trump White House?
We hope that that's going to be the case, and we're going to hold to Mr. Biden to what he had promised before he got elected. That's one thing. I mean, we do know that this war, this illegal war on Yemen, was started while Obama was in power. But then so much has happened since. And Biden was part of the people who have been a witness to the horrors that have been committed in Yemen in their names. And there's also potential legal liability, because sooner or later there's going to be international tribunal to investigate what has happened in Yemen. And there is a campaign ongoing at the moment in the US as well as in the UK, and an international day of action planned on 25th of January, with a view to reminding Mr. Biden about his promise before his election. So we do hope that the new US system administration will see common sense and stop this horror, because it's genocide, it's illegality, it's everything disgusting. It's not just illegal, it's disgusting. Because it's just the Yemeni blood being spilled every day. Young children, people are just dying hungry. This can't be right. And we're calling upon the international community, the rest of the Western world, who have a voice at the UN level, to advance a resolution to demand cessation of military campaign against Yemen, and to demand the lifting of this illegal blockade to save millions of lives. And of course, ignore this call for branding otherwise innocent and very good people at fighting terrorism, in fact, like Ansarullah, branding them terrorists when they are completely far from it, ideologically, politically, on every level. And what they're calling Ansarullah is not the government of Sana'a. The government of Sana'a does contain communists, it contains the Congress Party, it contains variety, many other political parties of the Yemen. So it is wrong to try and mislabel them deliberately by the U.S. and to follow in that footstep and regard this government as a bare militia when they are not. Otherwise, they wouldn't have such advanced military capabilities. Otherwise, they wouldn't be able to contain the country's institutions and preserve the national constitution. And majority of the people are actually internally displaced in their regions, the regions under their control, contrary to what's happening in the parts that are illegally occupied by Saudi coalition.
Right. Let's go back to Mr. McWallace in Brussels. Joe Biden takes office on January the 20th. Can and will the designation be revoked by Biden's Secretary of State? And if so, do you think the next administration will bring more of the same to the table? And if he does reverse it in time, will the damage be done by then?
Well, first of all, I don't expect the Democratic administration to be much different from the Republican administration going out. But secondly, what I would say is that the support for the Saudi-UAE bombing campaign in Yemen has been, apart from the fact that they've been able to sell all these arms to these two entities, apart from that, there hasn't been much positive in it for the Western countries involved, namely the US, France, and the UK, and unfortunately, other European countries as well have armed UAE and Saudis over the last couple of years. But I actually do think that it will be difficult, not that Biden thinks much different from Trump, because US imperialism will most likely continue on its merry way. Biden is happy for the US to spend $740 billion on military in 2021. The Democrats voted for it. They do not want universal health care for their own citizens. So, the madness of this, a country that has huge problems at home, they have huge demands on millions and millions of their own people needing a better life, needing better health care, better education, better social facilities. There's huge levels in America today. But yet, the US is still most likely to continue on its path of imperialism.
Okay, I'm going to have to jump in there. I'm sorry, Mr. Wallace, we're short of time. Allow me to thank my guests. Member of European Parliament of Ireland South, Mr. Mick Wallace, joining us from Brussels. Also, thanks to Director of Human Rights for Yemen, Kim Sharif, joining us from the British capital, London. Also, thanks for staying.